Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Rated G Radio. We have a fantastic show tonight. We have screenwriter Patrick Tobin who's going to be on the line with us. He is the brilliant mind behind the current Hollywood blockbuster Cake, which stars Jennifer Aniston, and we're going to ask him all the fun questions about the movie in just a couple of seconds. But I want to give a couple of shout-outs to people who are coming up to the show later on this week. Tomorrow we have Greg Archer. He will be on talking about his memoir, Grace Revealed. Thursday, we've got Hollywood legend Robert Michael Morris. And then Friday, we have, he's from Phantom of the Opera, folks, Kaffir. He stars in Phantom of the Opera. I think he just left that to pursue a career in pop music. He shared his pop music with us before, but Kaffir is going to be our guest on the Friday night dance party. He's going to be live with us at 5 p.m. Pacific time, 8 p.m. East, because he's got other gigs that he has to go to on Friday night, so we're lucky to have him. But without further ado, let's get to our star for tonight. It's Patrick Tobin. Patrick, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Garrett. I'm happy to be here.
This is a real exciting night for me for a lot of reasons. So I might geek out a little bit on you, but I'm thrilled to have somebody of your stature here on the show to talk about something that is near and dear to my heart, and that's writing and doing passion projects once you get to a certain point in life. And for everybody who's tuning in for the first time and has seen the movie, that's great, but now you get to actually hear the guy who wrote the movie and tell us the story behind it. So, Patrick, can you do me the favor of kind of telling us a little bit about yourself and some of the things that have been going on since the movie's been out?
Sure. So basically, I went to USC Film School in the late 80s. And had a great experience there. It's a really great program. I definitely emphasized writing. And got out in the early 90s and had a movie that was actually produced and at festivals in 95. So exactly 20 years ago.
Wow.
It was a great little movie. It was it starred Candy Alexander, who's a terrific actress. You've seen her on a bunch of stuff like CSI Miami. She used to be Whitney Houston's backup dancer. I mean, she's an amazing person. She did a great job. We did not get into Sundance. And at that time, if you had a little indie drama without a name and you didn't get into Sundance, it was like you just put your film away and it, died a slow death. And so the film never got distribution and, sort of licked my wounds from that, did a few things over the years in the late 90s. One thing I did, which was super interesting, I did some work with Alan Carr, who he's like, for gay men of a certain age, like, because I'm almost 50, it's like Alan Carr basically saved my, early years in Montana as a kid. It was like he produced Grease, he produced Can't Stop the Music, he's amazing. Amazing guy.
I didn't want to say Can't Stop the Music, but I was like, I know, that's where I remember Alan Carr from. What did you do for him?
So Alan had someone who worked for him who saw my movie No Easy Way, which is the movie that didn't get distribution, and he loved it. He just thought it was terrific. So he summoned me to his house in Beverly Hills. This was, he was starting to get ill, and he actually died a few years after I met him, but he had me to his house where all these sort of infamous parties had happened in the 70s and 80s. And he said, what else do you have? And so I said, well, I've been thinking about doing a gay version of Vertigo, the Hitchcock movie. And his eyes lit up and he's like, that would be amazing. And he's like, I actually know Pedro Almodovar.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I'm like, I'm not even 30 yet. I'm thinking, here's my career is going to take off. So Alan and I worked on that. Unfortunately, Pedro did not want to do an English language movie. He just wanted to do his own scripts, which was fine.
Okay.
And then you can't blame him. And then Alan had another idea that we worked on, and I developed that for him. And then he got sick, and he passed away way too soon. So when that happened, that was like 97, 98, I did a few more things. And about 2000, I just I got this feeling like this Hollywood's not going to happen. And I said, I need to make a living. So I started working in marketing and eventually ended up doing marketing for an engineering company. But at the same time, I also, and I think probably you relate to this and a lot of people, I still wanted to be creative. And, you know, marketing, although I liked my job and I was good at it, it wasn't fulfilling, you know, my creative side. So I just, I kept writing. I wrote some short stories, some essays, and started submitting them to literary journals and had some success. And in fact, Kate, the movie was originally one of my short stories that was published in 2008. And I published it. It got a little attention. It was in an anthology called Best American Non-Required Reading. And it was read at a Beverly Hills Library event where they had actors read short stories. And the actress who read Cake was just an amazing professional. And she read it, and the audience was kind of riveted. And I thought, you know, I think this might be a good screenplay. So all those years later, you know, it's like I'd let the dream go. I'd said, okay, Hollywood's not going to happen. And I started writing the screenplay. And that was I took a few years. You know, I would work on weekends and whenever I had free time. And eventually I finished. I entered it in some contests. And in 2013, it won a contest here in L.A. And the director, Daniel Barnes, was one of the judges. So he, like a Cinderella story, you know, called me up and said, I love this script. I want to do it. And we met, just fell in love. He's a great guy. He's a talented director, but also a really good person. And his husband, Ben, is his producing partner. So we joined forces, and within like 7 months, we were filming.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is crazy. Okay, so can you... Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was going to say, it's like the fastest, it's like the longest overnight success story.
Exactly. I mean, just like, where did you come from? Out of nowhere, Patrick, you know, and of course you've been, you know, doing it behind the scenes forever. So for the story of Cake, for the listeners who haven't seen the movie yet, can you kind of give us, and I want to talk about the movie later, but can you kind of give us an idea of what the story was about?
Sure. So Jennifer Aniston plays a character named Claire, and when the movie starts, she's got scars, she's disfigured, she's kind of an angry, antagonistic person. You find out she's in chronic pain, and, you know, she's kind of off-putting and sarcastic. And as the story unfolds, she attends a group for women with chronic pain, and the film starts, we find out that one of the members of the group has actually recently committed suicide, and that's Anna Kendrick's character. And for Claire, for Jennifer Aniston's character, she becomes obsessed with Anna Kendrick's suicide. And even though they weren't really friends in the support group, she kind of goes on this journey to find out how and why Anna was able to kill herself. And in the process, she seeks out Anna Kendrick's husband, who's played by Sam Worthington, doing his best dreamy Australian accent, I might add. And it's
very becoming.
With those blue eyes and that accent,
yeah.
Pretty devastating. So Jennifer seeks him out and develops this very quirky, somewhat dysfunctional, but also ultimately redemptive relationship with him. And the two become friends. And through it all, Jennifer Aniston's character is supported by her housekeeper, who was also, you find out, her child's nanny. Played by Adriana Barraza. And Adriana, as the housekeeper, is just a supportive, long-suffering friend and attendant to Jennifer Aniston. And it's just this, you know, it's a very, very character-driven piece. It's kind of similar, I think, in tone to Silver Linings Playbook. It's, you know, dark. It's definitely a dark movie, but it has humor in it. And at the end, you find out that Jennifer was in a car accident that killed her 5-year-old son, and she's been dealing with the grief and pain from that, and sort of that explains why she's this angry, you know, antagonistic person.
So when you got ready to write the short story for this all those years ago, you know, when as a, I want to go back and ask you about your writing style, I guess, you know, so how do you, how did you decide that, okay, I'm going to write Cake or I'm going to write this story or that story? And what drew you to the short story that ended up becoming the movie Cake?
So in 2002, a very good friend of mine who at the time was a priest in Stockholm, Sweden, he ran a support group for women with chronic pain. And he would tell me these stories about these women that, you know, how supportive and brave and inspirational they were. And one day he was telling me this, and I just envisioned this character, this woman who was part of this supportive, wonderful, warm, inspirational group who was just, you know, antagonistic, angry, sarcastic. And I just kind of fell in love with that idea of that character. And so it stewed for maybe a couple months, and I just kept thinking about it. And I sat down and I wrote the first scene, which is the first scene in the movie. It takes place at the support group. And it just, the character just kind of came out of me. I think, you know, and with that story that was, you know, inspired by my friend's support group, my brother, my younger brother, Tim, had a horrible tragedy in 98 where he lost his wife and daughter to a really tragic situation. And so I think just as an artist, it was taking that pain, you know, that we lived through with my brother, and then being inspired by my friend's support group, and it just kind of merged into this character. And I always, Claire, you know, Jennifer Aniston's character has always just been in my heart, you know, as sort of almost an actual person, which sounds a little creepy and maybe pretentious, but it's true. Like, Claire was definitely came to life, and when I wrote the short story and then the script, I always just listened to that character, and, you know, she took me on this journey that ended up being, you know, the film.
Well, and one of the things that I really thought was interesting about watching Jennifer be Claire in this movie is, you know, we're all used to seeing Jennifer play all these, you know, quirky romantic comedy or Friends type of roles, and we've seen her in a couple of serious things, but this is a movie that I just didn't expect to see her in, and she plays this very complex character of Claire who you're not sure if you want to like her or hate her, mm-hmm. and she does all of these things throughout the course of the movie that just, they're raw, and the nerve is exposed, and you are watching her go through these things, and you just have to sit there and shake your head, and it really did not feel like I was watching a character, you know, Jennifer play a character. I felt like I was watching Claire suffer through the things that she was going through. And so I think that the experiences you've had with your brother and then the support group that you were talking about just really came through on the page and, you know, ultimately on the screen.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, as a writer, I think you're always, whether consciously or subconsciously, pulling from your own experiences and emotional experiences. And just to talk about Jennifer, I mean, she is, without a doubt, one of the funniest comedians, you know, we've got in the world, and this is why she's a huge star. But I've always suspected, and certainly I've seen a couple of performances before Cake where I think, you know, she shows her range as an actress, and one of those is The Good Girl, which is a mm-hmm. wonderful little indie movie that she was terrific in. And then she was in a movie called Friends with Money that was, again, sort of a smaller
great film,
movie,
she's
terrific in that. And so I had seen those, and definitely Daniel had, and his producing partner and husband, Ben. And when we were sort of talking about, you know, who are actresses in their 40s who could play Claire, you know, it was a list of sort of, you know, names you would obviously recognize and sort of go, yeah, she could play that. But when we talked about Jennifer, it was like, you know, we all, the three of us, and then eventually everybody else who became involved with the project, I think really was drawn to the feeling that, you know, she would bring a certain humor and humanity to it, but also she had the dramatic ability to really pull off this character. And she just, when she committed to it, she committed fully. You know, she researched the project. She has a very good friend who is her stunt woman, who has been her stunt woman for many years, who had a situation where she had an injury that caused chronic pain for several years.
Oh my gosh.
Addicted to pills. And in fact, her name is Stacy, and I think Stacy and Jennifer did an appearance on Dr. Oz a few weeks ago or a month ago, and talked about that. And so Jennifer really, you know, tapped into that. She talked to doctors and psychiatrists and physical therapists. And the first day of filming, I remember I was just sitting there, you know, at the location, and she came out of the trailer in full makeup, you know, the scars, the sort of dowdy clothes and the hair that looked unwashed. And it was just like, you know, the first take, I was just blown away. I said, you know, she is absolutely Claire. She nailed it. I can't, as a writer, I was just like, what a blessing, you know, to have someone pull this off. And it is a tricky character.
And everything that she does. So it's, and for me, I think because the film seems like a slow movie, even though it's not a slow movie. But Jennifer moves so slowly, and so much of it because of the pain that she's in as Claire. And I see that. And I've had lower back issues before, and so when I see her like try to get into bed or get out of bed, or she's in the car and she's like, take this street, not that street, because it's. I was right there with her the entire time, and just was like, oh my God, I feel it right now. It's coming back.
I know people, I've gotten a lot of feedback or a lot of, I've heard from people, and they're just like, you know, you really start to feel her pain. And I agree.
Right.
I think she, you know, she nailed it. And what was interesting in the, you know, when Daniel rehearsed with her is they spent a lot of time just talking about what is causing the pain, what was the accident, you know, where did it affect her body? Because those are all things a performer has to think about when they're, you know, doing a scene. And there are times where she'll wince or move her head slowly,
mm-hmm,
or,
mm-hmm.
And you just, it's so believable because it's like, you don't, you just forget it's Jennifer Aniston at a certain point.
Right. Yeah. She's a spectacular actress in here. So can we talk about the relationship in the movie between Claire and Silvana, who was just a brilliant actress in this, and I think she really stole the show in a lot of regards. I wasn't really expecting that Silvana was going to be this hugely supportive, dynamic character, and here she is. But they both rely on each other, though, in this very unique way.
It's an interesting relationship. I mean, sort of the backstory that maybe you pick up from the movie, but definitely as a writer, I feel like Silvana, and she's played by Adriana Barraza, is, you know, she was probably the nanny to the child that ends up dying in the accident. You know, she's been around Claire for many years, has been with her through the worst of it. And I feel like, in a way, I always describe this movie as a love story between Claire and Silvana. It's, you know,
right.
It's about their relationship. It's not, you know, romantic or erotic. It's just, it's a true love story. And, you know, she puts up with Claire's addiction, her behavior. There's a lot of dysfunctional things that happen. And really Claire does her best to push Silvana away. And Silvana just, you know, puts up with it because in her heart she knows that this woman is suffering, and she really is a good person at heart. And I think the scene in the movie that always gets a huge response is when Silvana finally has had enough and she just starts yelling at Claire in Spanish. And, you know, you don't even really need the subtitles to get the subtext, which is, you know, I've put up with this and I'm done. And that for me is the great moment in the movie where Silvana becomes an equal to Claire. Like that's like if you're charting the love story, that's where they really become united. You know, it's where they're equals now, and Claire is able to see that this has been her true friend, her true friend who has seen her through this horrible period.
Now, the scene that I really like, I love that, and it was extremely powerful because there's several things that happen right before that really get you charged up for Silvana, and to say, Silvana, you need to read Claire's Riot Act here. But there was also a scene where the two make a journey in their car southbound, and Claire lets Silvana be the star of the day. And
right.
I was very touched by that because that was something that Claire did not have to do, but she made it. She really made Silvana look like a hero there, and I really am grateful that you wrote that scene.
Yeah, it was a scene that you know, as I was writing the story, and certainly in early drafts, the tone and the dynamic was a very hard one to, you know, balance, because you don't want Claire to be so antagonistic and unlikable that you just, the audience goes, I don't want to watch her anymore. And I just, as the scene developed where they go to Tijuana on a journey to, you know, pick up some pain medication, that scene just came out of nowhere almost. And as I explored it, I was like, you know, I really felt like it was a moment where you see Claire's love for Savannah and wanting
right.
to, her to have her dignity. And I think also just after that scene, they're talking about the aftermath of it. And you find out that Savannah has this backstory. You know, she's not just your typical, you know, Latina housekeeper.
She's got family too.
She's got family. She has a history in Tijuana. She's got, you know, she used to be middle class or upper middle class, and now she's not. And I felt like that was an important moment where you're just not like, oh, you know, she's, Savannah's this, you know, housekeeper.
Well, I think you loved Silvana before then, but you completely fall in love with her character after that because of, you know, all the things that you learn, and also the Claire, you know, just in my opinion, she really just didn't have to do what she did in the movie, and I'm just so glad that that's what the character did, because I think that really bonded Silvana to Claire just that much more, because, you know, as much as they were joined at the hip, I think that just put the complete weld on them.
Yeah, I think it's that first moment where, oh, we're friends. We're not just,
yeah.
you know, we're not, it's not an employment relationship. It's, we're friends, you know.
Now, the other relationship in the movie I thought that was really interesting, and honestly, Patrick, it creeped me out. It was the relationship that Claire creates with the husband of her friend that had committed suicide.
Right. Yeah, it's a very dysfunctional, ill thought out relationship that Claire embarks on with Roy, who's played by Sam Worthington. And, you know, Roy, played by Sam, is, you know, has lost Nina to suicide. They have a young child who's dealing with the aftermath. And Roy is just this sort of, as opposed to Claire, he's very real and honest with his grief. And, you know, initially I think Claire is drawn, she's sort of trying to solve the riddle of how and why did she kill herself? Like, was she able to pull this off? And I think as she gets involved in this friendship with Roy, it becomes something else. It becomes, like with Silvana, it becomes a true friendship or a true relationship rather than
it evolves.
Something. Yeah, it evolves. And I think Sam just really is great in that. He really is very wounded and angry and honest and just kind of says what he feels.
Well, I loved how his character accepted Claire for who she was, and he knew who she was before she showed up, but she just kept, like, showing up, and he's like, what are you doing here? You know, you need to go home type of a thing, and she just
right.
kept coming back like a lost cat.
Yeah. And it's an interesting, you know, and this was a good advice that a writing teacher, and it was actually for short stories, but said, you know, your story should always be filled with yes moments where, you know, something happens and a character says yes. And I think for Roy as a character, instead of saying, look, I think you're crazy, stop bugging me, he says, yes, okay, here's this weird woman who keeps showing up. I know that there's something off about it, but you know what? It is what it is. And I think in Roy saying yes, that takes the story in the direction it goes.
And I'm going to ask you a question here that I probably should have a doctor on, but since you're the screenwriter here, I'm going to ask this. So, again, for everybody who's listening in tonight, it's Patrick Tobin, screenwriter for the Hollywood hit Cake. Watching Claire through the movie, there were points in the movie that she's very lucid and seems to be very in the moment as far as what's going on. And then there are times in the movie she just seems completely out of it. From a writing standpoint, how do you write that type of behavior for the character when throughout the whole movie they're just always chronically hurting and in pain?
So what was interesting is, you know, I did a lot of research, even back with the short story. I contacted, you know, some doctors, I talked to the American Pain Association, and really delved into it. And also I have a bad back too. So I have, I'm familiar with, you know, taking Vicodin. That's about as strong a drug as I've ever taken, but I was familiar with how they make you feel. And so what I did when we actually were doing the story, and in fact, when Jennifer came on board, is we went through the script and we're like, okay, where is she with the drugs, with the alcohol? And you sort of, if you look at the scenes, there's this definite, it's almost charted, you know. When she's on the pills, has taken them recently, and she's drinking, that's when she's the most out of it. When she's not drinking and she's in between doses and the dose is wearing off, that's when she's the most irritable and, you know, lucid and just razor focused. You know what I mean? Like, she has those moments. So if you, and I've seen the movie like 6 times now, and I'm always just amazed with her performance because she's really true to the physicality of what's happening in her body. And then obviously when she, there's a scene where she's been drinking a lot and she's taken a lot of pills and she's just, you see it in her eyes. They're like glassy and she's hardly able to keep her eyes open. So it's true to, I think, what the drugs and the alcohol are doing. There was a lot of thought that went into making sure that that was real. And she's taking Percocet, which I've never taken, but my dad actually was on Percocet for a while. And that does cause hallucinations. My dad,
really,
when he was taking it, he called me one afternoon and he said, I just got off the phone with Obama. And I said, really? That's interesting. What'd you guys talk about?
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, you know, Obama wants me to be on this committee for, you know, to deal with the economy. And my dad's a retired CPA, and I just said, oh, I said, really, that's really, I said, Dad, I want you to do something. I want you to hang up, and I want you to check your call history, and if there's a 202 area code, I believe that Obama really did call you, but let me know. And he called me back like 5 minutes later, and he says, well, there isn't a phone call. And I said, oh, but it was so believable to him. It was endearing.
Wow.
And funny, but there were a few other things that happened, and so that's very true, I think, to Percocet, and she's taking Percocet. That you do have hallucinations.
Now, she was on, I don't know, probably like 4 or 5 or 6 different types of medications, it seemed like, throughout the course of the film. Are people who are experiencing chronic pain, is that typical that they are on a cocktail of different things, or is that just kind of how the movie was written?
Well, it's definitely true to that experience. I think, you know, there's the real, like, if you, like, I think, I don't want to put a judgment on it, but I think, you know, the more evolved approach to managing pain is, A, we're not going to completely be able to get rid of it. So I think, you know, we're not going to give you a lot of drugs to mask it completely, because if we do, you're not going to be able to function. So the goal is really, what's the minimum amount of pain medications we can put you on? And it might be a cocktail, it might be a variety of things. And then what they'll do is they'll also get you into physical therapy, alternative therapies like acupuncture or electrical stimulation or other things to, you know, manage your pain. Claire, I think, which happens a lot in this country, is she is, through her own actions, able to slip through the cracks. So, you know, she's got a variety of places she's getting drugs. And, you know, in America, you can go to a doctor and get pain medication fairly easily.
Right.
And then you can go to another doctor and get, I mean, anybody listening, and probably you or me, we could go into a doctor tomorrow morning and come out with a script for Vicodin or something else. You know, it wouldn't be that difficult. And I think,
I think you show that too in the movie. You know, she goes to this place and that place, and, you know, she's able to fairly easily get it. But the volume of pills that she takes far outweighs the prescription supply, which, you know, I think dictates that trip down to Tijuana.
Right, and then I think, you know, and what really happens for people with chronic pain is, you know, and this is the problem with drugs, is that at a certain point they stop working, or you need more. And this is what I found out early on, is in a weird sort of unintuitive way, it's like you have worse pain because you're masking your nerves and they're trying to figure a way to get to your brain, and then so the pain becomes worse, and it's like this sort of spiral happens. I've heard from a lot of people with chronic pain since the movie came out, and that's been one of the coolest parts of it is to hear from people. And
have you had any
great?
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just think like it just you know, people who've been suffering for years, who some have been in really bad places, and I think the movie, they really feel identify with it and are appreciate, you know, having the movie's not like a public service announcement, but it's definitely, you know, chronic pain is part of the story.
Well, it certainly raises awareness. So have you had I don't want to say a success story because that sounds really kind of for me, it sounds kind of creepy to even say that word, but have you had a success story or somebody come to you after the movie and to say, you know, this has changed my life or because of this, this has happened, anything like that yet?
I've had, you know, several people reach out to me, and I don't want to, like, out them, you know, publicly, but I have, I think, in small ways been able to either encourage people or the movie itself has given them, you know, certainly a feeling of being heard, which I think is for somebody in this condition is you tend to feel isolated and not understood. And I think, you know, having a movie where your situation is dramatized, maybe, you know, very highly, but it still shows what you're going through. And I think, you know, I've heard definitely from people who said, you know, I just want to thank you for this movie. It really, you know, I sat in the theater and cried for an hour at the end of it. And, you know, it's kind of encouraging them to carry on. Because at the end of the movie, it's very, you know, very much about hope and moving on with your life and trying to, you know, to not give up. And
absolutely. Now, is it, are we giving away too much if we talk about the symbolism of cake in the movie, or do we need to have people go to the theater to see that?
No, we can talk about it. I mean, I think it's not giving away too much. So the cake story, Claire finds out or remembers that Nina, who's the Anna Kendrick character, has talked about one of the things she wished she could do if she didn't have chronic pain was to actually make a cake from scratch for her son. And this comes out later in the movie, and so really it's about Claire trying to do, you know, to do something to honor Nina's memory to her child, and I think cake is just, it's a, you know, it's a celebration. You know, I think cakes are part of you know, birthdays or anniversaries, mm-hmm. or big, you know, milestones or events. So I think it works on a few levels.
Oh, okay, so now can we go kind of like behind the scenes? So number one, everybody has to go out and see the movie Cake. It's in limited release or it's national release, but it's, what would you call it? Is it a limited release right now?
Yeah, I think I heard it's kind of 400 theaters, which is pretty wide, but it's not going to be at like a million multiplexes.
So you got to go search it out. But the movie Cake is, I went to go see it on opening day. I paid my money and went and got a big bucket of popcorn, which I never, ever eat. I ate every last kernel. It was delicious. So I was eating popcorn watching Cake. But sat in the theater with, you know, everybody else and was watching it live at the multiplex down here and absolutely loved it. So if you can go out and see that, that would be really cool. And then, you know, write in and tell us what you thought of the movie. But behind the scenes, when this decided to be, you know, become a big, big darn deal in a motion picture and all of this, what did you guys, you told me a story off air about when everybody got together and started sharing ideas and things like that. Do you remember that story or, you know, what you're doing to kind of get everybody to collaborate? Yeah.
Yeah. So so Daniel Barnes, who's a very talented director, he had done 3 feature films before Cake. And on all of his films, what he found helpful is to have like a retreat weekend about a month before shooting started. And he would have all the department heads come and to his house. And so you go a Saturday and Sunday, you come in the morning, you have, you know, food and beverages, you stay for dinner. So the department heads would be like the director of photography, the costume designer, the production designer, the producers, and me as the writer. And it was really just an open forum. So he said, you know, read the script, or, you know, obviously everybody had read the script, but think about the script, think about ideas, things that are inspiring to you. It doesn't have to be, you know, fully formed storyboards or anything, but just bring, you can bring in video clips, you can bring in photos, music, anything that makes you think about this project or think is sort of in your, the back of your head. And so for 2 days, it was this group of people, and none of them had done this sort of thing on their previous projects. But
wow.
Everybody brought in these clips and photos and color swatches. And what was amazing to me, and it was really exciting, and he told everybody, you don't have to limit it to your area. So the costume designer could talk about the look of the film and, you know, maybe the colors and things other than costumes. And it was weird how everybody was kind of on the same page from almost the first day of this retreat, where everybody brought in clips, and it just... I think the finished film really reflects that weekend back in, you know, March that everybody spent at Daniel's house and just talked and talked about feelings and impressions and emotions.
Very cool.
I was like, it was very cool, and you know, just I think he, you know, illustrates Daniel's just such a generous director. You know, I think he wants to bring out let everybody, you know, bring out their creativity and have them contribute. And everybody did. I mean, I remember, you know, there were some stills that the costume designer brought that, you know, had this sort of evocative feeling. And it's like, there are moments in the movie where I just remember that weekend and things that were shown.
Oh,
and Daniel
gosh.
Would say the same thing. It was really cool.
So when you're going through this process, because, you know, this, at the same time the movie is filming, you're still doing your, you know, I call it the day job, but you're still doing your day job. Did you have any favorite moments that were on set when you were able to attend?
One of my favorite moments was there's a scene where Anna Kendrick is floating in a pool. It's nighttime. She's dressed in a very fancy gown, and she's on one of those floating lounge chairs. And I just remember it was the end of a long day. It was like 3 a.m. It was freezing. This was April, and we were up in the valley, like up near Chatsworth, I think. And it was cold. Everybody was tired. And there was Anna Kendrick in this, you know, very glamorous outfit on this floating lounge chair. And there were production assistants who had fishing wire attached to the lounge chair that were off screen, making sure that it stayed in position. And Anna has, like, I think 2 lines of dialogue. And so they start shooting, and she is such a pro, and she's so talented. And she ran through her lines, and she did them, like, 6 or 7 different ways, you know. And I'm like, okay, this is why you're a star. You know, I felt the same thing with Jennifer and Sam Worthington and everybody else. It's like, this is why you people are stars. You're just so talented. And such a pro, you know. She was so delightful, and she's just as fun and funny in person as she is, you know, on these talk shows. And she just, you know, I'm like, you know, you're a big star. You can be a little cranky. It's 3 a.m. It's cold. You're out on a pool, you know. And then, you know, I just, I remember going to shoots and just seeing, you know, 50 paparazzi, you know, waiting for Jennifer, and really realizing her life, you know, how, you know, America and, you know, tabloids, and, you know, she just can't go anywhere without, you know, people saying, oh, is she pregnant, or is she, when's she going to marry Justin? And, you know, I she's a lovely person, and I was like, wow, this is really intrusive, you know. And it's funny, because when I would go to the set, you know, the photographers would be like, oh, is this somebody? And then they go, oh, it's just the writer. the cameras would go down. It was like, oh, you're not Justin Thoreau.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, yeah, you probably get confused with Justin quite often, so it's an honest mistake.
It's a professional, you know, hazard.
You know, it's the price you pay. Now, okay, so now that the film is done and it's out and you've been running around all over promoting it, what is it like being on a red carpet?
It is almost like an out-of-body experience, because it's, you know, it's lit with, you know, it's all these bright lights, and so it has kind of a surreal feeling already. And there's just, you know, dozens and dozens of photographers and cameramen and news reporters, and it's that sound, you know, and it's amazing. You just go down this sort of gauntlet of, you know, people. And I remember in Toronto, I had never done a red carpet. And so the PR woman before, she said, I hope you're okay with this. And I was like, sure, what are you talking about? And it was like 50, like, reporters and camera people, and they're like, look over here, look over here. And then they would ask questions, and you're trying to give good sound bites. And I got a sense of like how much effort goes into promoting and publicizing a film. It's definitely it's a war effort, you know, and and it was really fun. It was like reporters from India and South
wow.
America and Ireland. And, you know, it was just like, it's just, you know, it was really great. And then, you know, I came home to the hotel room afterwards with Joe, my husband, and we were just, you know, exhausted and just laughing, you know, how surreal this was, you know, that here I am, you know, like a year ago working in an engineering company in Anaheim, and now here we are in Toronto, and you're talking to, you know, 50 different reporters.
Wild, wild. You mentioned your husband, Joe, who I've had the pleasure of meeting, and you make a lovely duo. I will tell you that up front.
Oh, thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you met, and maybe, you know, one of his musical idols, and how that played into the matchmaking?
This is a very funny story. So Joe is a huge fan of Yoko Ono, and we met at a conference. We were sitting next to each other, and as often happens at conferences, there'll be like an icebreaker exercise. So the leader of that particular session said, okay, turn to the person on your next to you, and you're going to ask each other these questions. And so and there were questions like, what is your favorite color? What is your favorite food? And then one of the things, who is your favorite musical artist or group? And so Joe's going through his answers, and he says, well, my favorite musician is Yoko Ono. And I thought he was joking. So I like laughed my head off, and I was like, that's hilarious. And he was looking at me like, no, I'm serious. Yoko Ono's not. And I'm like, who likes Yoko Ono? So we were both kind of mixed with each other. And we just kind of were like, and I remember like other people were having really a lot of fun with their partners and laughing and sharing stories. And Joe and I were done. Like after the Yoko Ono question, we're just kind of like turned, you know, away from each other. And we're like, okay, I'm done with you. And then the next day we were at a different session, and we sort of, you know, patched things up, as it were. And we ended up talking, and we were, from that moment on, we were a couple. That was almost 17 years ago. So.
Well, congratulations. Now, one person I do need to give special thanks to tonight for putting us together for the show tonight is Kurgan Edward Stout, who's been a frequent guest on the show. But not only is he a great friend to both of us, but just a superior human being. And so a big thanks to Kurgan, because I know he's listening tonight. So Kurgan and Russell, hi to the boys. So
Kurgan and Russell are like the two nicest guys
ever, right?
They're
absolutely
incredible. They're incredible,
and they're genuine.
They're totally genuine. And Kurgan is just an amazingly talented writer. So, thank you, Kurgan and Russ.
Yeah, so Kurgan. Oh, I do have a question from Mary Lou, who is in the Blog Talk chat room tonight, and she is asking, "Do you know when the movie will be released in Australia? Because she would like to go see it."
I don't know what the time frame is for overseas release. I know hopefully it will be this spring, I'm imagining. I think in the UK and Australia. And it's only in North America right now, but I think it will be overseas within a month or two, I would imagine. So
cool. So there you go, Mary Lou. Keep your eyes out and go see Cake. So, Patrick, we've got a little bit of time left here on the show tonight. So what are you working on now? Because it's obviously you can't just rest on your laurels. You got to have your next project – or 50 lined up.
Yeah, so I'm working on a few things. One is a feature project that I've been writing with some producers I met last year. It's a really fun period piece. It's like a loving homage to, I would say, like Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis comedy musical duos, and just that period where you had, you know, as a kid in the 70s, you had things like Match Game and
yeah,
the Dean Martin roast, and it's like it seemed like everybody was drunk and funny and witty, and it's just a very, it's a very cool project. So hopefully, knock on wood, something will happen with that soon.
Nice.
And then, you know, Ben and Daniel, the director and producer of Cake and I are working on another, adapting a short story of mine, which has been taking some time. It's a sci-fi piece, and it's definitely has, as you start to get into certain elements of sci-fi, it's not like, you can't fake it. So,
right, right.
It's a different challenge than Cake was, but it's definitely something I hope will be, turn out really well.
Let me ask you this then. So, and when I ask the question, we both know it's silly because you've written more than one thing ever in your life, but people take a look at Cake and say, oh, this is your first big thing. So what
right.
are you going to do to top this? Are you having any type of sophomore remorse as you get into this new project about, oh, I've got to make it bigger and better and faster and stronger than Cake because everybody's going to expect it. But, you know, it's completely, completely different. There's no comparisons here at all.
Yeah, I think there was definitely for me as a writer, it was like, okay, well, you know, and the success with Cake was so great. And it's such a, when you talk about it, I mean, I think people are somewhat amazed it even got made. You know, it's definitely not like a big budget, complicated, you know, comic book adaptation. It's just, it's a very simple story, but it's, you know, has a certain flavor to it. And it's, I have such a wide variety of interests that, you know, my next projects are very different, but it wasn't consciously decided that way. It just sort of became that way, you know. But I will say, you know, there's definitely, having written Cake and had it produced and have with the success it's had, you know, I think certainly people are like, oh, you can do drama with comedic elements. You can write roles for women, which I think there's definitely should be more movies, you know, with female leading characters. So that's been nice, and I think if that's sort of part of my brand, if you will, that's fine with me. I love it.
So if you were to tell the listeners one thing that you would really like them to know about you or your journey tonight, what might that be?
I think, you know, I would just say to anybody who's doing anything creative, you know, you don't ever give up, because if you give up, you know, I think, as I found with myself, anytime I wasn't writing, I was very unhappy and not fulfilled. And I think there's that aspect of it. But also, I feel like I spent a lot of years just feeling bad about where I was, like with my writing career or lack of writing career. And I really wish I could go back to myself and just say, you know what, just enjoy your life and your writing. And if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, that's okay. You know, you just enjoy what you're doing and try to do a good job. And, especially my younger self coming right out of graduate school, I wish I could sit down and just say, you know, relax. You're young, you've got all this ahead of you, and you think you have to accomplish huge things by the time you're 30, and that's not the truth. You know, the truth is just keep writing and write good stories, just keep improving, and you know, because I think it's, you reach a certain point in life and you just start to realize what's important and you relax about certain things. And I think when I did that, that's sort of when Cake happened in a very quick fashion. So
I love that advice. Do you like to attract people social media wise? Do you have places you'd like people to go and find you and find out more about your projects?
I'm definitely online. I have a website that I update semi-regularly. I also have some of my short stories and essays on available to download for free. It's patricktobin.net. And, you know, I certainly love people going and, you know, writing me emails. I try to, you know, respond to people through that. And I don't use Twitter yet. I don't know why, but maybe this year will be when I go on.
There we go. Well, Patrick, this has been a huge honor for me. So number one, thank you very, very much for coming on the show. That's that's just for the show. But number two, I'm going to tell you, it's been a joy for me personally to get to know you and Joe outside of this element, and I'm really looking forward to spending more time with you guys this year. So thank you very much for that.
Absolutely.
Everybody else, this is this is Kelly's Lot, and we have Kelly Zerbas. She's actually listening, but this is one of her songs. She's been a guest on the Friday Night Dance Party recently. This is her song, Reason for the Blues. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. Okay.
Holding on to heaven ain't easy to do. When the devil comes knocking and he looks like you, you're the only reason I play. Holding on to your love is hard and cold. Oh, but baby, you got me down deep in my soul. You're the only reason I never say no.
Thank you.
I love Kelly's Lot, and that is their song, Reason for the Blues. That is off of their album, Don't Chase My Blues Away. It's available on iTunes, but you get an autographed copy if you go to Kelly's Lot's website and tell her that you heard it here on the show, and she'll autograph it for you and send it out. So I would recommend doing that. So go buy Kelly's Lot CDs. There's a mess of them out there, and if you like blues music, rockabilly music, you will love everything that you hear from Kelly's Lot. What a talented singer. I have to just pinch myself. I can't believe we just had Patrick Tobin on the show for the whole show talking about Cake and his experience in screenwriting. I may be a little verklempt. I'm just having to, you know, kind of catch my breath a little bit. But while we do that, let me say hello to some of the listeners who we've got. We've got Mary Lou, again, in Brisbane, Australia. I've got Mark, he likes to be called Dip, down in Sydney, Australia. I've got, of course, Kelly Zerbis. She's on the line right now up in the Ventura area. I've got Anita in Oregon listening, Laura in Orange County, Robert in Orange County, John in Orange County, John, and I got another John, John in Connecticut, Anthony in Long Beach. We've got Renee in the Inland Empire, Wesley in Georgia. I've got Angela here in Orange County with her husband, Ken. Thank you, Downey's Desserts. Bill in upstate New York. I've got Stephen and Margaret out of Phoenix listening, and the list goes on. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I appreciate you really listening to just somebody who is chasing his dreams and making things happen. And I think one of the reasons I really enjoy Patrick's story is because, you know, much like myself, you know, he pursued this great big job in corporate America for many, many years, and then decided to really kind of push and start pursuing some of his dreams. And look at him being so successful is just such a welcome thing. It could not have happened and is happening to a nicer guy. So thanks again, Patrick Tobin, for being on here. Quick reminder for the rest of the world. Well, if you didn't hear last night's show, you're one of about two people in America that didn't, because we had Dr. Annie Ulrich back on the show, and she talked about February energy and also took listener calls about life and the pursuit of happiness. Wednesday, tomorrow, we've got Greg Archer. He is our king of pop culture roulette. He is back to talk about his memoir, Grace Revealed. It's about his family's struggle going through Polish-occupied Stalin internment camps, going to Africa and being all around the world and finally ending up in Chicago. He has an update from a recent appearance that he made yesterday, I believe, if memory serves, and he's going to be talking about that and why that is a life-changing moment for him. But his book is called Grace Revealed. You can get it on, you know, where do you buy books? You buy them on Amazon today. Thursday, we've got Robert Michael Morris. He is a Hollywood legend. He is going to be calling into the show and talking about all of the things that happened in Hollywood yesteryear, telling us great stories, and I'm looking forward to that. And, of course, Friday night, we have Kafir, the star of Phantom of the Opera on Broadway. You know, like in New York City, big darn deal. Kafir will be back on the show talking about his new pop music, and we're going to be playing some of his recent hits in hour one. And in hour two, of course, it's always listener request. That's going to start at a special early start time at 8 p.m. East, 5 West. That is on Friday the 6th. Next, let me just tell you, this is what we've got going on, folks. Next week on Monday, we have an interview with Michael Vaccaro. He is the star of Child of the 70s. They have a third season that's getting ready to debut. Can't wait for you to hear that. We did a pre-record live last week, and I've got it all put together. It's really cool. On Tuesday next week, we have Ian Verdun. He's going to be talking about his web series called Life's a Drag. And Lisa Johnson, who has written this incredible, huge book, it's called 108 Rockstar Guitars. She just also sponsored at the NAMM convention. If you don't know what NAMM is, let's see, National Association of Musicians and I don't know. It's NAMM. It's a big darn deal. It's the hugest thing that happens in the music industry for like non-type of Grammy type of things. She sponsored a Rock Awards ceremony there, and Lisa's going to be on the show next Thursday talking about her book. They sent me an advanced copy of this thing, and let me tell you, and it's the paperback version. The paperback version is like a huge encyclopedia volume. You know, it's like an M version, or maybe an L version. You know, it's a big, thick version. Gorgeous book. And if you go online to Amazon, the hard copy book is $400. I think it's like $440. So they sent me the advanced copy of that, and I'm really, really grateful to take a look at that and have Lisa on the show next week. But that's what's going on here on Rated G Radio. I encourage you to like the show on Facebook. It's Rated G Radio on Facebook. You can follow the show here on Blog Talk Radio. You will get an email or text update every day with the unique show link for that particular episode, and you can always stay in tune. And you can also make this a podcast thing. The bottom right-hand corner of your screen there on the computer for the show, you click the RSS feed or something like that, and it takes you to the iTunes store, and you click it, and I'm a podcast for you. There you go. I'm going to kind of round out the rest of the show with another Kelly's Lot song since, you know, we're in the spirit here. It's called Boom, Boom, Boom. We've got about 30 seconds left, so enjoy this, and we'll see you live on Wednesday. Don't drive distracted. Have a great night.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.